Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. You can visit the Commonwealth Club at www.commonwealthclub.org. Many of our older events are all recorded there. You can listen to the podcast for free. And I'd also like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure today to introduce Harriet Smith, one of the co-editors of the Mark Twain Papers. I'd like to say a little bit about this, because this idea came many, many months ago to have this event. We are only 11 days away from Mark Twain's 179th birthday. And he wrote, or dictated, an autobiography towards the end of his life. And he requested that it not be published for 100 years in the Mark Twain Papers. Who I think got their permission from his daughter Clara to handle all the materials, actually published the first volume of this right on the 100th birthday, actually followed through on that. His reasoning was that, you know, he didn't want either his relatives, he wasn't worried about himself, he was already 75, he didn't want his relatives killed for some of his opinions that he was going to put out, and so he thought they'll let 100 years go by. And it's a nice thing that we don't kill writers for their opinions, because nothing that he said would get you killed nowadays. But neither relatives or idea people get killed for their ideas, at least not very often. And so it's an interesting thing that he, an interesting insight into how different at least his mindset was coming from the mid-19th century in his formative years, to think that that was a really important thing to do, to wait 100 years. So the other element of this is he talks about the difficulty of speaking the truth. Now, I'm going to be giving a lecture in D.C. on November 30th, on his birthday, actually, that I've been invited to give. And part of it is the difficulty of speaking the truth. Actually, it's a sort of different thing. But his issue was not so much the stuff that would get you in trouble and get you killed as the stuff that's just, we're just never emotionally honest about. We never actually admit to ourselves or to anybody else what we really feel and think about things. And this is very difficult. What was he said one time? He said, I counted the other day, and I found that I lie in only 47 different ways. I don't know how I came to be so honest. Something like that. So Harriet Smith, the co-editor of the papers, Mark Twain Papers, to speak about the second volume of the autobiography, which is housed at Bancroft Library at the University of Berkeley, right here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about Mark Twain and speaking the truth, as George explained. Volume one of the autobiography was published in 2010, the centenary of his death.
As now published in full for the first time, having been suppressed at the author's wish for 100 years. The second volume came out last year. The third volume will be in print next year. It's already gone to the press. Now, this marketing strategy of announcing that something had been censored, coupled with Mark Twain's name, was pretty much a guaranteed formula for success. And in fact, the book sold a remarkable number of copies in the first year, over 500,000, which for us is beyond imagining. It was on the bestseller list for 18 weeks, and it's now been published in 5 other languages: German, French, Italian, Japanese, 2 volumes in Japanese, and Chinese. And there are rights that have been granted to other languages as well. Mark Twain would have greatly appreciated the interest in his book and the fact that the idea of having it censored was so appealing to people. When Huck Finn was published in 1885, it was banned from the children's shelves of the Concord, Massachusetts Public Library. And Mark Twain gleefully wrote his publisher that they had called it trash and suitable only for the slums. And that will sell 25,000 copies, sure. Mark Twain first contemplated writing an autobiography in the mid-1870s. It was a full 30 years before he actually began the almost daily dictations in January 1906 that comprised the bulk of the autobiography. But he knew from the beginning he didn't want to write a conventional autobiography. The most familiar of these was probably Benjamin Franklin's, truly the iconic rags-to-riches story in our culture. But Mark Twain made fun of that. He was very irritated by the preachy, didactic tone and claimed that the incendiary comment of early to bed and early to rise, etc., had caused him to be raked out of bed at an unseemly hour way too frequently in his childhood. And he quoted passages from Franklin in a magazine article in the Galaxy magazine in 1871 and commented with his typical droll humor, making an allusion to the constant rags-to-riches theme and the self-aggrandizing of Franklin's autobiography. Clemens said he was always proud of telling how he entered Philadelphia for the first time, with nothing in the world but 2 shillings in his pocket and 4 rolls of bread under his arm. But really, when you come to examine it critically, it is nothing. Anybody could have done it. For one thing, he knew he didn't want to write a chronological account of his life. He wanted to be able to meander from topic to topic and talk about whatever appealed to him in the moment. And this enabled him to write pieces, chapters of the autobiography over the next 30 years that he simply set aside for later use. And ultimately, he selected some of these to include in the final version and discarded others. But he was also concerned with the whole issue of how self-revealing to be, how honest to be about his opinions, and the consequences of expressing himself frankly. He talks about this in a letter to his brother written in 1880 when his brother was contemplating his own autobiography. And he makes reference here to 2 other famous autobiographies, one by Benvenuto Cellini, the 16th century Italian artisan, and the Swiss-French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau of the 18th century. He wrote to his brother, "Benvenuto tells a number of things that any other human being would be ashamed of. But the fact that he tells them seems to be very good evidence that he was not ashamed of them. And the same, I think, must be the case with Rousseau and his confessions." Rousseau confesses to masturbation, theft, lying, shameful treachery, and attempts made upon his person by sodomites. But he tells it as a man who is perfectly aware of the shameful nature of these things. So it's clear that Mark Twain, on the one hand, was shocked, but also he marveled at somebody that could be so honest. And he knew that he was not one of those people. He had established himself in the Literary Society of New England in Hartford, and he cared very, very much about what people thought of him. And he did not want to jeopardize that position. And I think he must have made note of the fact that both of these autobiographies, Rousseau's and Cellini's, were in fact published posthumously. In fact, Rousseau commented on that fact in his Confessions. He said, "My confessions are not intended to appear during my lifetime, nor that of those they may disagreeably affect. Were I master of my own destiny and that of the book I am now writing, it should never be made public until after my death and theirs." Now, that's a remark that Mark Twain himself could have made. And I do think that that might have planted the seed in his mind of doing the same thing, that he could publish when he was dead, unaware, and indifferent. Excuse me, I do get very dry. And he made the following statement. It is only by keeping steady in my mind that my autobiography is not to be published until I am dead, that I can force myself to say the things I think, instead of merely saying the things I wish the reader to think I think. Only the dead can tell the truth. And that brings us to his other concern. Was it even possible to tell the truth? We're speaking in very abstract terms here. And we'll later talk about what he may have had in mind when he talked about speaking the truth, because that can mean many different things. And he puts this in the autobiography. I urged Orion, that's his brother, to try to tell the truth and tell the whole of it. I said he couldn't tell the truth, of course. That is, he could not lie successfully about a shameful experience of his, because the truth would sneak out between the lies, and he couldn't help it. That an autobiography is always two things. It is an absolute lie, and it is an absolute truth. The author of it furnishes the lie. The reader of it furnishes the truth. That is, he gets at the truth by insight. So this is a recurring idea that he comes back to over and over again in his statements about the autobiography, that the author can't tell the truth, but at the same time, he actually does tell the truth, despite himself. Over the next 3 decades, as I mentioned, he wrote a number of chapters for the autobiography, some of which ended up in the final version. But they were always pigeonholed, set aside, until he felt he was really ready to begin. In the 1890s, in fact, he veered off course for a while and decided he didn't want to write an autobiography. He was interviewed by a journalist in Vienna who published an article, and the article said, "This is a work which is only to be published 100 years after his death as a portrait gallery of contemporaries with whom he has come into personal contact. These are drawn solely for his own pleasure in the work and with the single object of telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, without malice and to serve no grudge." He said, "I'm not going to write autobiography. The man has yet to be born who could write the truth about himself." Well, ever the mercurial person, of course, this idea didn't last long. That was a dangling participle, but the editor in me is like. In 1904 in Italy, he did return to the idea of autobiography. And then he decided to adopt the means of dictation, which was quite a novelty at the time. And he wrote a letter to William Dean Howells, his friend, again, talking about his challenge of speaking the truth. He wrote, "Although an autobiography inevitably consists mainly of extinctions of the truth, shirkings of the truth, the remorseless truth is there between the lines, where the author cat is raking dust upon it, which hides from the disinterested spectator neither it nor its smell. The result being that the reader knows the author in spite of his wily diligences." While the family was in Italy, his wife passed away in June of 1904. And again, he put aside the autobiography. But he finally took it up again in January 1906 with these nearly daily dictations, which continued with diminishing frequency into 1909. And he wrote a preface, and this preface touches on some of the topics or some of the reasons that he, in fact, wanted the work suppressed. He says, "In this autobiography, I shall keep in mind the fact that I am speaking from the grave rather than with my living tongue, for a good reason. I can speak thence freely. When a man is writing a book dealing with the privacies of his life, a book which is to be read while he is still alive, he shrinks from speaking his whole frank mind. All his attempts to do it fail. He recognizes that he is trying to do a thing which is wholly impossible to a human being. My editors, heirs and assigns are hereby instructed to leave out of the first edition all characterizations of friends and enemies that might wound the feelings of either the persons characterized or their families and kinship. From the first, second, third, and fourth editions, all sound and sane expressions of opinion must be left out. There may be a market for that kind of wares a century from now. There is no hurry. I'm going to take a look at the different categories he talks about here. For example, he mentions sound expressions of opinion and so forth. We know from the type dictations that we have in the office exactly the kind of censorship that he intended to carry out. For one thing, he did publish a number of chapters from the autobiography in the North American Review in 1906 and 1907. And so he wrote on these typescripts that he was preparing for publication the word changes that he wanted to make to sanitize the words, sanitize the text for a contemporary audience. Just as some brief examples, the expression two ripe old maid sisters became two middle-aged maiden sisters. Thieves were called buccaneers. God was altered to heaven, and so forth. As you can see, these are fairly minor changes, but they do reflect his concern about keeping the language high-toned, not offensive. But we also know the material that he wanted censored because that was the material he set aside deliberately, writing on the typescripts, not to be used, no, and so forth, when he selected the material he did want published. So I'm going to read some examples of this material just to give you a sampling of the kinds of things that he wanted to suppress from a contemporary readership. His principal topics, of course, were politics and religion, the Mark Twain that we're familiar hearing all the time now. For example, he commented on the war in the Philippines, and as you probably know, he was a strong anti-imperialist, and this always got his back up. The official report stated that the battle was fought with prodigious energy on both sides. This is the American army versus the natives in the Philippines, during a day and a half, and that it ended with a complete victory for the American arms. The completeness of the victory is established by this fact, that of the 600 Moros, not one was left alive. The brilliancy of the victory is established by this other fact, to wit, that of our 600 heroes, only 15 lost their lives. And this is one of my favorites, his little rant about Thanksgiving Day, very appropriate this time of year. Thanksgiving Day is a function which originated in New England two or three centuries ago, when those people recognized that they really had something to be thankful for. Annually, not oftener, if they had succeeded in exterminating their neighbors, the Indians, during the previous 12 months, instead of getting exterminated themselves. The original reason for a Thanksgiving Day has long ago ceased to exist. The Indians have long ago been comprehensively and satisfactorily exterminated, and the account closed with heaven, with thanks due. From old habit, Thanksgiving Day has remained with us, and every year, the President of the United States puts those thanks into a few crisp and reverent phrases in the form of a proclamation. And this is read from all the pulpits in the land. The national conscience is wiped clean with one swipe, and sin is resumed at the old stand. I think the comments he makes on religion were the ones he was most afraid to reveal. Some of these would be considered blasphemous today in some circles. And he wrote his friend Howells about the dictation he was planning to make on the following day. This is in June 1906. He wrote that these dictations would result in having his heirs and assigns burnt alive if they ventured to print them this side of 2006 AD. The edition of AD 2006 will make a stir when it comes out. I shall be hovering around, taking notice, along with other dead pals, and you are invited. On this typescript, he noted it was not to be published for 500 years. The God of the Old Testament is a fearful and repulsive character. He makes no pretense to the possession of a moral or a virtue of any kind, except with his mouth. No such thing is anywhere discoverable in his conduct. Ours is a terrible religion. The fleets of the world could swim in spacious comfort in the innocent blood it has spilt. Very eloquent. And here he talks about what he calls the virgin. He calls it the Immaculate Conception, but actually he's talking about virgin birth. He says this would get him ostracized and cut off from all human fellowship. There isn't any carpenter in New York that would take Mary's testimony at par. If the Immaculate Conception could be repeated in New York today, there isn't a man, woman, or child of those 4 millions who would believe in it. It would produce laughter, not reverence and adoration. Now we have to remember how very shocking this would have been in 1906, especially in circles where everyone was allegedly a Christian or a Jew, but nothing else really existed in his world. But one of the other categories he mentions in the preface is his characterizations of people. He calls it people he wanted to mangle and mutilate beyond the dreams of avarice. And this included wealthy and powerful men, political figures in public life. The McKinleys and the Roosevelts, and the multimillionaire disciples of Jay Gould, who in his brief life rotted the commercial morals of the nation and left them stinking when he died, have quite completely transformed our people from a nation with pretty high and respectable ideals to just the opposite of that. The gospel left behind by Jay Gould is doing giant work in our days. Its message is get money, get it quickly, get it in abundance, get it in prodigious abundance, get it dishonestly if you can, honestly, if you must. Roosevelt was, in fact, one of his favorite targets. In some sense, he liked Roosevelt in terms of personal interaction. He enjoyed his company, thought he was an enjoyable fellow, but his politics were absolutely not acceptable. Mr. Roosevelt is the most formidable disaster that has befallen the country since the Civil War. But the vast mass of the nation loves him, is frantically fond of him, even idolizes him. It sounds like a libel upon the intelligence of the human race, but it isn't. There isn't any way to libel the intelligence of the human race. Mr. Roosevelt is the Tom Sawyer of the political world of the 20th century, always hunting for a chance to show off. In his frenzied imagination, the Great Republic is a vast Barnum Circus with him for a clown and the whole world for audience. The scattering of other remarks about people that are not well known today, but give you an idea of the kind of language he liked to let fly. His landlady in Italy, whom he absolutely despised, she was living with her the steward of her estate, shall we say, above the stables, which was absolutely not done in his world. She is excitable, malicious, malignant, vengeful, unforgiving, selfish, stingy, avaricious, coarse, vulgar, profane, obscene, a furious blusterer on the outside, and at heart, a coward. I think that kind of covers the gamut there. Another friend of his, Charles Henry Webb, a literary man, a poet, he writes, Webb believed that he was a literary person. He might have gotten this superstition accepted by the world if he had not extinguished it by publishing his things. They gave him away. His prose was enchantingly puerile. His poetry was not any better. Yet he kept on grinding out his commonplaces at intervals until he died 2 years ago of over-cerebration. He was a poor sort of a creature and by nature and training a fraud. As a liar, he was well enough and had some success, but no distinction. You know you didn't want to get on his bad side, that's for sure. Another favorite target was Bret Hart. Now, Bret Hart was somebody that he had actually been very friendly with in San Francisco. And Hart had mentored him very early on, gave him advice when he was working on his first book. And the two remained friends for a while after Hart went back east in 1871. Hart's career, however, went downhill from there while Clemens was on the rise. Bret Hart was one of the pleasantest men I've ever known. He was also one of the unpleasantest men I've ever known. He hadn't a sincere fiber in him. He undertook to give all the product of his brain for 1 year to the Atlantic Monthly for $10,000, a stupendous sum in those days, furnished nothing worth speaking of for the great pay, but collected and spent the money before the year was out, and then began a dismal and harassing death in life of borrowing from men and living on women, which was to cease only at the grave. I'll talk later about what truth there may be in that, and maybe not. Bret Hart has deserted his family. That is the plain English of it. Possibly he writes them, but I am not weak enough to believe it until I see the letters. Possibly he is pining to come home to his deserted family, but no one that knows him will believe that. But there's one thing about which I think there can be no possibility of doubt, and that is that he has never sent them a dollar and has never intended to send them a dollar. We come to another category. It's a little more elusive that he mentions in the preface. He calls this the privacies of his life. Now, when we look at the early dictations, we find a lot of charming scenes of domestic life, vignettes of the family, the children's sayings, his interactions with his wife, and so forth. But as it turns out, this material was virtually all published in the North American Review in his own day. And therefore, clearly it can't represent the privacies that he wanted to hide. In fact, he makes one very startling confession that you would expect to be the kind of thing he would suppress. But in fact, he published it in the magazine. It refers to the death of his infant son, Langdon, who died at 18 months in 1872 of diphtheria. He wrote, I was the cause of the child's illness. His mother trusted him to my care, and I took him for a long drive in an open barouche for an airing. It was a raw, cold morning, but he was well wrapped about with furs, and in the hands of a careful person, no harm would have come to him. But I soon dropped into a reverie and forgot all about my charge. The furs fell away and exposed his bare legs. By and by, the coachman noticed this, and I arranged the wraps again, but it was too late. The child was almost frozen. I hurried home with him. I was aghast at what I had done, and I feared the consequences. I have always felt shame for that treacherous morning's work, and have not allowed myself to think of it when I could help it. I doubt if I had the courage to make confession at that time. I think it most likely that I have never mentioned it until now. Throughout the autobiography, in fact, confesses to a long series of human failings. He calls himself a fool and illustrates this with numerous examples of his bad investments and his gullibility with finances. He calls himself assful, one of his favorite words. Vain, attention-seeking, impatient, unable to control his temper, and prone to violate etiquette and embarrass his wife. But of course, we find these comments disarming. They aren't things that we would really condemn him for, and the very fact that he confesses to them deflects our criticism. He makes the point over and over again that he's no better than the rest of the human race. He writes, "I am the whole human race without a detail lacking. I have studied the human race with diligence and strong interest all these years in my own person. In myself, I find, in big or little proportion, every quality and every defect that is findable in the mass of the race. What a coward every man is, and how surely he will find it out if he will just let other people alone and sit down and examine himself. The human race is a race of cowards, and I am not only marching in that procession, but carrying a banner." Now, this is strong language, and I'm sure we wouldn't take it at face value. But in some sense, he was a coward when it came to expressing his opinion. There were people in his era, probably most famously Robert Ingersoll, other atheists, who were quite willing to go in public and speak the things that he was not willing to speak, because they didn't fear losing their reputation. They were willing to stand by their opinions. And I think that we have to acknowledge that Mark Twain was not of that ilk. His reputation mattered more to him than speaking the truth. And he admitted, after he'd been dictating the autobiography only 3 months, he said, "I have thought of 1,500 or 2,000 incidents in my life which I am ashamed of, but I have not gotten one of them to consent to go on paper yet. And I think that that stock will still be complete and unimpaired when I finish these memoirs." That was, in fact, the case. 3 years later, when he had reached the point where he was losing interest in the autobiography and was contributing almost nothing to it, he made a comment to his friend Howells. And Howells reported this in a book he had written about Mark Twain. He claims that Mark Twain said, as a perfectly veracious record of his life and period, the autobiography was a failure. He had begun to lie, and that if no man ever yet told the truth about himself, it was because no man ever could. This, of course, completely echoes what he had been saying 30 years earlier, and he had proved his own prediction that despite his intention to tell the truth, he still couldn't bring himself to do it. Well, what exactly does he mean by telling the truth? I can't go into that at great length, and I'm sure this is something covered at much more profound levels by George's upcoming talk. But briefly, first of all, clearly lies of omission. He simply can't set down on paper the things that he was ashamed of. And we can't know what those are. We have only the documentary record set down by himself and his friends. And whatever those shameful acts, surely there weren't 2,000 of them. We have to give a glance to the fact that he was not to be taken at face value. He loved bombastic rhetoric and exaggeration. So that's the other fact. He was fictionalizing. He was writing a piece of literature. He wasn't writing a court deposition or an accurate biography of somebody. He didn't really care whether he was telling the truth about Hart or not. He wanted to tell the truth about what he thought of Hart. And in fact, much of what he said about Hart, as we point out in our annotation, this is one of the things we try to do without quibbling too much with the author, put things in context. Hart wrote his letter. He did leave his family in the U.S. His wife was, well, for lack of a better term, a real bitch. And she made his life a misery, making demands on him that he couldn't meet financially. He took off for Europe. He accepted a consulship. For the next 15 years or so, he sent back every penny that he earned from his consulship and tried to live on the meager returns from his writings. Did he live off women? No, he was befriended by a couple who took him in, respected his work, and allowed him to live with them and their children so that he could write. Did he send money? Yes. Did he write letters? Constantly. There are several volumes of his letters to his family in print today. And it's clear that he did his best under the circumstances, given that he was totally estranged from his wife and divorce wasn't a possibility. So we have to acknowledge that Mark Twain wasn't really trying to tell the truth in this instance. On some level, he probably knew that. He didn't want to make the effort to find out one way or the other because that was beside the point for him. Also, he knew that in almost every story he told, he couldn't resist elaborating, embellishing, making literature out of it. That is, in fact, what he did. So, clearly, that was not what we would call lying. But I think he actually does mean that to some extent when he talks about he had begun to lie. We all remember things through the filter of our memory. The emotions we feel at the time, in particular, distort our memories of what happened. Anger, resentment, or joy. And none of us can recount the same event the same way twice, nor can two people that experienced the same occasion describe it the same way. This is simply a given of the human experience. And I think that he was alluding to that fact as well. It's unavoidable. If I describe my mother, she's not the same person my sister will describe. There's just no way that we had that same experience of the same person. And he comments on this too. When we are hot with the fires of production, we would even distort the facts of the multiplication table, let alone the facts of Genesis. So what about this larger issue? Can we actually read between the lines, as he claims? Well, it's interesting. I found his exact comment on that fact in a strange place. It's in a book called Christian Science, in which he attacks Mary Baker Eddy, makes fun of her. He actually had some respect for the whole concept of mind cure, as he called it, but not for Mary Baker Eddy. And this is what he says. An autobiography is the most treacherous thing there is. It lets out every secret its author is trying to keep. We've heard this before. It lets the truth shine unobstructed through every time he tries to do the modest unconsciousness act before the reader. This is not guessing. I am speaking from autobiographical personal experience. I was never able to refrain from mentioning, with a studied casualness that could deceive none but the most incautious reader, that an ancestor of mine was sent ambassador to Spain by Charles I, nor that in a remote branch of my family there exists a claimant to an earldom, nor that an uncle of mine used to own a dog that was descended from the dog that was in the ark. So this will give you some idea of how seriously we can actually take some of these remarks. The opening essay in the autobiography, which was one of the manuscripts he wrote in 1897 in Vienna, actually includes these comments about his ancestor being ambassador to Spain and an earldom in the family. This book, Christian Science, was published in 1903. So he published this essay where he uses these very facts in the NAR, in the North American Review, in 1906. So there's some irony here in that by explaining the things that he was trying to suppress and how he couldn't suppress them, they were in fact not suppressed, right? We do see something else when we look between the lines in the way that he indicates. As I mentioned, we do see that he was reluctant to reveal himself for fear of being ostracized. That's a word that he uses more than once. He didn't want to embarrass people. He cared a lot about being revered, about his position in society. But we also see a theme, a recurrent theme, which is a fascination with, almost obsession with, the whole concept of telling the truth. And I think that the quotes that I've read to you today, which repeat the same idea over and over again over 40 years, makes it clear that this was something that was constantly in his mind. Now, other writers have done analyses of Clemens's psychology, and they go into the fact that he did have a tendency to feel guilty about things that he probably had no reason at all to feel guilty about. He took this blame upon himself. I think the instance of the young Langdon is typical. It's a good example. It was actually in mid-May when little Langdon fell ill. Hard to see how it could have been really a freezing morning. And, of course, diphtheria was very common in its day. And yet he somehow held on to the notion that it's a form of self-aggrandizement in a sense. I don't want to get into the psychology of it, but he felt the same way about the death of his sister. The family said that he predicted her death, and he somehow felt responsible for that. He felt responsible for the death of his younger brother Henry, who died in a steamboat accident because the two had been on the same boat together. And Clemens had left the boat, and then the Pennsylvania blew up and poor Henry was scalded to death. So these tragedies that accumulated in his life burdened him with this real sense of guilt. It had something to do with his Presbyterian upbringing. There's an incident in Huck Finn, for example, where he gives a match to a man in the jail and the jail burns down, and he felt guilty about that. That's a reflection of a real experience in his life. So he was part of the chain of events, but hardly the cause of the tragedy. Well, as I mentioned, he lost interest in the autobiography. By early 1909, he really had set it aside and started stuffing in some manuscripts that he'd saved to bulk it out, but really not dictating anymore. But he came up with a brand new idea, which was writing letters and not sending them. I think this is something, I don't know about you, but I've done it. When I really wanted to express something, but then was afraid of the consequences, write it all out, and then not send it. And he mentions three of his friends here, Howells, H.H. Rogers, who was a vice president of Standard Oil and a very close friend, and the Reverend Joseph Twitchell, a congregational minister who was his lifelong confidant. So this is what he says. A stenographer is a lecture audience, yet you are always conscious of him. He is a restraint. You are not talking to yourself. You are not thinking aloud, processes which ensure a free and unembarrassed delivery. If it's a she person, there are so many thousands and thousands of things you are suffering to say every day, but mustn't, because they are indecent. If it's a religious person, your jaw is locked again. Often you are burning to pour out a sluice of intimately personal and particularly private things, and there you are again. You can't make your mouth say them. But that newborn scheme, that splendid scheme, blows all these obstructing and irritating difficulties to the winds. I will fire the profanities at Rogers, the indecencies at Howells, and the theologies at Twitchell. Oh, to think I am a free man at last. Well, we have only one such letter. In fact, it's a 420-page manuscript. We call it the Ashcroft Lyon manuscript. It's being published in full in volume 3 of the autobiography. Although it's not technically part of the autobiography, it's been a source of great interest to scholars. It's really a caustic indictment of the two secretaries that worked for him. He came to believe that they were defrauding him, and he simply lets loose every negative adjective he can think of. He calls them a putrescent pair, for example. I mean, he's uses wonderful language. And it's somewhat painful to read. Again, he feels guilty because he had allowed one of these secretaries, Miss Lyon, to sequester his daughter, who had epilepsy, in various sanitariums and hospitals and keep her away from home when she really didn't need to be away from home. And when he comes to realize this, he realizes that he's neglected his daughter, and he brings her home finally for what turns out to be the last months of her life. In late 1909, he wrote something called Letters from the Earth. He told a friend, this book will never be published. In fact, it couldn't be because it would be a felony to soil the mails with it. And I think in this book, which actually was not published until 1962 because his daughter forbade it, I think we find at least some of the things that he was not able to put in the autobiography. The premise of this book is that the Archangel Gabriel comes to Earth to comment on the curious proceedings of man, his ridiculous conception of heaven and of God. He mocks Christianity again, of course, in this work, and I won't repeat the same ideas. He uses stronger language, perhaps, but it's essentially the same thing that I quoted to you earlier from June 1906. One of the things he says is, having thus made the Creator responsible for all pains and diseases and miseries, which he could have prevented, the gifted Christian blandly calls him our father and comments that any human father who treated his children the way God treats people in the Old Testament would be thrown in jail. But the most surprising thing is he talks about sexuality in Letters from the Earth. It's the only place he really says anything on that subject, especially female sexuality. So here's a typical passage. Women are competent as the candlestick is to receive the candle, competent every day, competent every night, but man is only briefly competent. After 50, his performance is of poor quality. The intervals between are wide, and its satisfactions of no great value to either party, whereas his great-grandmother is as good as new. That is the law of God, as revealed in her make. What becomes of this high privilege? Does she live in free enjoyment of it? No. Nowhere in the whole world. She is robbed of it everywhere. Who does this? Man. And he does it without consulting the woman, although she has 1,000 times more at stake in the matter than he has. You have heretofore found out by my teachings that man is a fool. And you are now aware that woman is a damned fool. The autobiography ends with a heartrending essay called Closing Words of My Autobiography. It's a tribute to his youngest daughter, Jean, who died of an epileptic seizure in the bathtub on Christmas Eve, 1909. I think we have to conclude that, for the most part, he did not speak his whole frank mind, certainly not as he had hoped that he could. In another sense, he didn't spare people's feelings either, because Roosevelt's children, for example, when they read excerpts about Roosevelt that were published in the 1940s, were exceedingly offended. Roosevelt loved Mark Twain, kept a copy of A Tramp Abroad next to his bed. His children were deeply hurt to find out what he really thought of their father. Clemens himself died only a few months later, in April 1910. But his ideas and his voice clearly live on, and in that sense, the autobiography is by no means a failure from our point of view. It is a triumph of originality. Now, admittedly, it isn't of uniformly high literary quality, but it is, in fact, something else. It's a remarkable legacy. It's unique in its structure and in its medium, that it was dictated largely. And its spontaneity gives us a window into the workings of a unique mind and shows Mark Twain's amazing facility to express himself in an impromptu way, in striking and original language. So in a sense, his hope was fulfilled. There was a market for that kind of wares, and in fact, the book has made a stir. Readers are still interested in what he has to say. And I think I like to imagine that he's still hovering around to taking notice with his other dead pals and thoroughly enjoying the spectacle of his great popular success. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Harriet Smith, one of the co-editors of the Mark Twain Papers at the Bancroft Library, talking about the second volume of his autobiography. Now it's time for questions. We have about 10 minutes.
I wonder if you could comment on the more potentially autobiographical parts of these papers, namely, is there anything in them that relates to the two main published works of his that were largely autobiographical, Life on the Mississippi and Innocence Abroad?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Many of his literary works are, to greater and lesser extent, autobiographical.
Those are frankly autobiographical.
Yes.
And is there anything in the papers that relates to them, expands upon them, contradicts them?
I guess I would say no. Nothing that particularly comes to mind.
Yeah, and a related question maybe. In all your years working in the papers, how accurate is his memory? You have access to all kinds of other details.
That is an interesting question, because as editors, one of the things we do is research things that we can learn about his actual life. And his memory can be very accurate. He had a remarkable memory for certain things. In other cases, not so much. Or, as I said earlier, maybe he wasn't even trying.
Thank you. That was very insightful. There was the instances you mentioned where he felt guilty, the match, for instance. And I just had to shrug my shoulders and say that he was a victim of the post-hoc fallacy the post-hoc ergo propter hoc in Latin, translated as, well, just because it precedes it doesn't mean it caused it. After which, because of which, that's another way of saying it. Someone needed to point that out to him. Too bad.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody hadn't done that. There's been a fair amount of essay writing on that very topic, and I didn't go into that deeply today because it was tangential.
Not to edit Samuel Clemens, but based on what you said, I believe he made the common mistake of confusing what's referred to as Immaculate Conception with the Virgin Birth.
Yes,
and,
he did.
Okay.
For the rest of you, if you don't know, the Immaculate Conception refers to the conception of Mary as without original sin, not the Virgin Birth. But yes, he does get that wrong.
My wife is also an editor, and so she asked that I ask you if you could expand on the role of the editor in this process in the publication of the autobiography.
Well, in this instance, it was different from his other works, because each dictation, in a way, had its own textual history. So in brief, we often would have three different versions of the same dictation. He would revise one, and it would be retyped, and then he would revise that again for publication. One of the things we had to do was to try to sort out the revisions that he made that were aimed specifically to censor the work or modify the language for a contemporary audience, because we wanted to publish the version that he intended, well, the phrase we used in the office was intended for all time, as opposed to intended for immediate publication. And that did involve some difficult decisions sometimes. Now, all of our decisions and all of the revisions that he made can be seen on our website at MTPO, which has a complete scholarly textual apparatus. And also, by the way, the entire text of the autobiography, two volumes are up and the third volume will be up, in very easy to use format. It's very sophisticated, with windows down the side. You can click on this and see the notes, and click on that and see the textual variants and so forth. But the other thing we do, of course, is annotate, which is pick out the things, essentially, that we think need explaining or that we want to find out. And it's always a matter of judgment. We work as a team. nobody works alone. Everybody's work is reviewed by everybody else. So it's a process we've gotten used to over the years. Some people are more comfortable with it than others. But we do try to point out if there's big discrepancies between what he says happened and what we know happened, the historical evidence. And then also just explain topical allusions, things in the news of the day that people now couldn't possibly understand that would have been, he's not thinking about a future audience in that sense. So we do try to explain that as well in the annotation. So those are the two sides of it, the textual editing and the annotation.
Clearly he was very good at what seems to me is name-calling. He was very witty at it, at least. Do the materials in the autobiography contain serious engagement of the ideas of other people and arguing with them or critiquing them? Or is it all...
Serious. It's hard to pin Mark Twain down and say when he's really serious. On the whole, no. I mean, he's really not making a rational, pointed argument in most cases. He obviously writes with great passion about the evils of imperialism, but he doesn't write the way a political scientist would write. He writes in a way that would illustrate the horror of it and express his opinions about it. You can call that serious, but I don't think it's serious quite in the way that you intend it.
An observation and a question. I've been giving a lot of thought recently to how to place the Grateful Dead in the American experience, in the American context. And there's a clear line back to the Transcendentalists, I think, which is very interesting. But more and more I've been thinking about the affinity with Twain, especially in the areas of irreverence, the tall tales. And so there's a big connection there. And in fact, the summary that you gave at the end of the autobiography could easily apply to the Dead's body of work. So that's very interesting, and thank you for that. And I look forward to reading this second volume. But my question is there anybody today that you see that does the same sort of thing that Twain did in his day in terms of observations of the American experience and
well,
the American culture?
I think John Stewart comes to mind as probably the prime example, yeah.
In terms of Twain's atheism, how much of it did he share? You said he didn't share it publicly for publication in his lifetime. How much of those thoughts did he share with his close friends and acquaintances?
I think he was very frank about it, and I don't think he would have... I used the word atheist. I don't think he would actually apply that term to himself. Maybe we'd say agnostic. He really totally rejected the structure of Judeo-Christianity, the literalness of the Bible, man's view of what God was didn't seem right to him. But I don't think he ever outright denied the existence of some kind of greater power. On the other hand, his wife lost her faith over the years because of listening to his talk about it. He had started out when they were courting to say he would become a Christian, and of course it all went the other way in the end.
Another question? No. Okay, great. Thank you very, very much. And so ends another event in the 112-year history of the Commonwealth Club. Thank you very much for coming.